Welcome to Queer Music Heritage, and this is J.D. Doyle. I'm heard every month as a part of Queer Voices on KPFT, and the song I open with is by one of my favorite bands, Pansy Division. It's from their first album from 1993 called Undressed, and the song is Femme in a Black Leather Jacket. I'm very pleased this month because I get to share with you a special interview I did with John Ginoli, the founder of Pansy Division. And he's been very busy lately. The band has just released their 9th full-length album, and it's called That's So Gay. And a new documentary has been hitting the film festival circuit called Pansy Division, Life in a Gay Rock Band. That's out on DVD now. And John's written a book called Deflowered, My Life in Pansy Division. So he's been traveling the country on a book tour. I'm very glad he stopped in Houston, as he was able to come by for an extensive interview. Let me tell you how this show will be set up. My interview with John will be split into two parts, with a lot of it being in part one, the segment designed for broadcast radio. But if you know anything about this band at all, you already know that most of the joy of their music comes from the boundaries they've always gleefully leaped over. Their music celebrates gay sexuality, and they were one of the first to do so with such explicit lyrics. Many of their songs, well, I can't even read the titles on this show. That's where part two will come in. That can be found on my website as an internet-only version. Of course, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. But wait, there's more. In preparation of this show, I also decided that on QMH, I've never really done justice to the punk music genre of queercore. And the main reason why is the same one that's prevented me from playing very many Pansy Division songs over the years. It's the lyrics, folks. So as long as I'm extending this show to the internet, I'm going to attempt the very daunting task of covering the genre of queercore, focusing mostly on the early 90s. I'll finally play such bands as Team Dresch, Tribe 8, Fifth Column, Go, God Is My Co-Pilot, Fag Bash, and on, about 5 hours worth. And if you've ever dug into queercore at all, you've heard of JD's Top 10 Homocore Hits. You'll hear about that as well, because in this special segment, I have a very interesting interview with G.B. Jones, who is credited with being one of the first influences on queercore, both for her work with the fanzine J.D.'s and in the band Fifth Column. so hold on to your seatbelts when you visit those segments. But let's get started with my John Ginoli interview. Pansy Division was not John's first band. For several years in the mid-80s, John led a band called The Outnumbered.
I had wanted to be in a band, have a band since I was a kid. So throughout college, I had the idea of wanting to do a band. And as college was finishing up, I finally started writing songs. And I think I was 20, I started playing guitar and writing songs. So The Outnumbered was my first band with, you know, all the ideas of my childhood, my youth, building up, thinking, you know, what would I finally do if I got to have a band? So that was my first band. We were in Champaign, Illinois, and the band was successful. We were together 5 years. We made 3 albums and a single. We played over 200 shows and went all over the country. The Outnumbered was, you know, started when I was 22 years old, and it broke up when I was 27. And I just listened to a lot of The Outnumbered's music again recently and just thought, wow, this is the music of a disillusioned young man who just got out of college. It's the Reagan era, and things pretty much seemed to suck. I was working at Kinko's. I wanted to try to play music. The music scene just seemed, you know, mainstream music scene just seemed really dispiriting, really horrible. So I thought, well, I guess I'm just, you know, an outcast, and here's me doing my music, and I'm just going to do it the way I want it to.
I want to stop and ask about one of the songs by The Outnumbered called I Feel So Sorry Now.
Yeah, that was actually the first really good song I wrote, and it really wasn't about anybody in particular. It was just thinking about various things, thinking about what a relationship would be like and a situation I might find myself in, but it really wasn't written from experience.
Was that the basis for Homo Christmas?
A variation of that is what I used for the music for Homo Christmas, yes. Because I wrote Homo Christmas in a hurry, and it was right before Christmas of 91. And we were going to play a show. It was the week before Christmas, and that afternoon I decided I wanted to write a Christmas song just for the show. And it turned out to be a really good song, but I stole from myself to get the music in a hurry because I had to do it right then.
We'll hear Homo Christmas on part 2 of this interview, but here's a bit of the song it grew from, I Feel So Sorry Now. The band Outnumbered released 3 albums. That was from their first, from 1985, called Why Are All the Good People Going Crazy? I know this is a very well-known fact, but this is a history show. I can't not ask how you came up with the name Pansy Division.
It was a complete accident. I was working at Rough Trade Distribution, which was a wholesale independent record distributor in San Francisco. And the left side of my desk was against a wall, and on that wall was a bulletin board, and Rough Trade distributed releases, and Rough Trade label put things out. So there was a list of upcoming titles that were being distributed, and one of them was a band whose record never came out because Rough Trade went bankrupt, called Third Panzer Division. I don't know what kind of music it was. I think it might have been electronic. So I could see the bulletin board out of the corner of my eye, because it was to my left. If I'd look forward, I wouldn't see it. But out of the corner of my eye to the left, I would just glance at it, and I thought I saw the phrase Pansy Division instead of Panzer Division. And I thought, Pansy Division? That was right when I needed a name for this gay rock thing that I was contemplating doing. And I thought, wow, that's a really good name. I thought, well, I'm going to hold on to that until I think of something better. But I was satisfied with that pretty quickly. I heard the phrase pansy. It really wasn't used where I live to as a put down, but it was on Monty Python. And Monty Python, you know, that's how they would refer to the gays, as, you know, pansies, you bleeding pansy. And I thought, I like that, pansy.
What did you want the band Pansy Division to be?
I wanted it to be blunt, unapologetic, and in your face, because I'd moved to San Francisco and had gotten involved with ACT UP and Queer Nation, especially with ACT UP. I was pretty active for a couple of years. And what that showed me was, it showed me a lot of possibilities, including the idea that a bunch of activists and radicals out on the edge making a lot of noise and being to some people unreasonable were able to create a lot of space in society for other people to kind of follow in step behind them. People who don't want to be the first to draw all this attention. But once somebody else is able to make that point, they're able to be there and agree and build on that. I saw from ACT UP how effective that could be. The experience of being involved with those queer activist groups made me think I could do something that was musical, but was still, instead of being like a political activist, I'd be a cultural activist. I wanted to sing about sex because I thought sex really hadn't been talked about in and celebrated in a direct way. It's always couched in terms of something else. I thought, I will be blunt. I will be out. It's the time of AIDS, the time of Jesse Helms and right-wing people attacking gays, saying we're monsters. And I thought, instead of being, instead of trying to placate those people, and who really couldn't be placated anyway, I would just try to be as out and as direct and unapologetic as I could be. I thought, that will be something that I think I can do that nobody else is doing.
Not a lot of people know that before Pansy Division, the band, released its first album, Undressed, in 1993, John, on his own, had recorded a tape, also called Undressed, sold mostly in San Francisco record stores. It had the exact same track listing as the recording that came out later. He got some friends to help him out on the other instruments, but really, there was no band. This was several months before he put an ad in local papers and found Chris Freeman. So I want to play for you the almost demo version of Femme in a Black Leather Jacket and get John to first tell us about the song.
I had the idea to do a gay band, and I thought, well, this is what I want to do. What am I going to sing about? And Femme in a Black Leather Jacket was the first thing that I wrote. It was the first song that I wrote for Pansy Division. It turned out to be one of our best songs. It's actually a composite about several people. It was just about a kind of guy that I liked. I had always thought, even with Pansy Division or The Outnumbered, my previous band, that I wanted to write a song that I could listen to that I felt like nobody else had done before. And that's what that song was for me. I thought, what can I sing about? How can I sing about this that is different, that I can't pull a record out from my record collection and say, ah, this satisfies that feeling? So that was my first impulse to write about desire in a uncensored way, with the pronouns being correct.
Black leather jacket, he's a femme. In a black leather jacket.
So how did people react to your in-your-face sexual lyrics?
In San Francisco, pretty damn well. I was in the right place at the right time. You know, I went over really well from the beginning. And I remember the second show I did was a benefit for Queer Nation. This is when it was just me. I didn't have a band yet, but I was calling it Pansy Division. Just me and my electric guitar. And I played this benefit and all the dykes left the room. Which I was pretty disappointed that kind of cleared the room of women. So I was very happy that the very next show that I did, my third show, was actually at a queer cabaret called Clubstitute, which is kind of legendary in San Francisco. I was opening for Tribe 8, who I had not heard of. And I think it was their second or third show. And suddenly here were dykes that were right on the same wavelength as me, but they had a whole band. And that was exciting to me. So it was, after seeing them and sort of, you know, playing a few more months on my own, I thought, all right, time to look for a band.
And, as I said, an ad in local papers found him a kindred spirit in Chris Freeman, and with their first of many drummers, they signed with the label Lookout Records and released the first album. In the film, you and Chris talk about how you didn't expect your audience to be so young.
That is because we ended up on Lookout Records, and Lookout Records had, as a label, a lot of bands that appealed to teenagers. But the style of music we were playing was appropriate for what the Larry Livermore, who started the label, was trying to go for. First album came out, and immediately we started getting letters from teenagers. We thought, okay, we're not aiming at teenagers, we're aiming at people who are like us in our 20s and 30s, because that's how old we were, thinking, okay, it'll be people like us who don't really appreciate the music in the gay scene and have wider variety of tastes than you're supposed to have if you're a homo. So then the record came out on Lookout and we started getting letters from kids. Not exclusively, but way more than I would have expected. And that was really good because Chris and I have said many times, the band we started is the band we didn't have when we were teenagers, when we were kids. For us, it's satisfying that people that age can hear it. But that was how we ended up with a younger audience, first thing. Then the second thing was the Green Day tour. So probably before we did the Green Day tour, our audience was, I don't know, 80% gay, 70%. And after we did the Green Day tour, our audience was probably 80% straight, because suddenly there were all these teenagers who discovered us through Green Day and got into our music. And a lot of them thought it was really cool and would write us letters telling how they said, I saw you open for Green Day, I'm straight, but I'm a member of the Gay Straight Alliance at my high school, and I think your music is fantastic, and, you know, it really seemed like we connected with a lot of kids, and that was a wonderful surprise.
Now that we're talking about Green Day, tell us about that whole phenomenon.
We had been on the same label as Green Day, Lookout Records. Their first two albums came out on Lookout. Then they got signed to Reprise Records, Warner Brothers. That first album on the major label came out at the beginning of 94 and was building up, and they were becoming popular. They were catching on. By the time they called us to ask us to open for their summer tour, their first video had gotten on MTV and was really taking off. So when we did the tour, by the time that tour began, which was almost 2 months after they called us, they had gotten huge, and all these places that had been booked were way sold out. Where they could have played, you know, 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 times the size of venues we were playing on that first tour. So they had gotten popular suddenly. They were very loyal to their old label. You know, they'd heard us and thought, all right, here's our opportunity. We're really getting popular. We want to do something that will show people what kind of values, what kind of people that Green Day are. And by having a band like us open for them, made a statement about who they were. It was using the power they had, you know, their sudden popularity, to put us up there on the platform with them and say, here's what we believe in. Having this band on open for us is making a statement. They're a great band, but also they do something unique. I mean, Green Day weren't political particularly then, but a lot of their songs are about personal politics and identity. So we matched well with them, and they were getting bigger and realizing that these kids coming to see them were just treating them like any other band. They're just like, you know, this week's new flavor. And they thought, no, we want to do something to differentiate ourselves from any other new band that's out there. And having Pansy Division opening for them made that statement.
In the film, Matt Wobensmith said the biggest thing in the 90s for the queercore movement was you touring with Green Day.
I think that's true. Matt says this is in the film. People were dismissive of the whole idea of queercore, like in the press. There weren't very many people who were covering us. So the fact that we were suddenly visible in a really mainstream setting made people who might not have written about it or thought it was too insignificant to warrant coverage to suddenly take it seriously and give it a good look.
And pause a moment to tell my listeners who he is.
Matt Wobensmith was the guy who founded Outpunk Records, and he also did Outpunk Magazine. When we decided that we would be the gay band, and, you know, if nobody else wanted to be out, then we would be out, his idea was, well, if there's going to be gay bands, I want to put out their records. So he put out Tribate's first EP and put out a Pansy Division single and started to put out records by other queer bands that were starting to materialize about the same time.
Okay, we've kind of skipped a bit too quickly through the early years of the band, and they released an album a year through 1997, adding to their catalog ones called Deflowered, Pile Up, Wish I'd Taken Pictures, and More Lovin' from Our Oven. I want to cover some of those songs, but I admit, some of the ones I want to play the most, well, you'll have to go to part two for those. From the list of the ones I can play is one from the Pile Up album from 1995 called I Can't Sleep, which is
About my experiences trying to get laid in San Francisco and how frustrating it could be.
Wish I could turn on my light and read my village voice, but laying next to this beached whale, I haven't got the choice. He looked good at the time, I must have been out of my mind. Now I can't sleep, I can't sleep. Hoping for a wild night of sexual gymnastics, but he thought he was God's gift, selfish and sarcastic. I wanted to take him home, and I got him so I shouldn't groan. But I can't sleep, I can't sleep. Minutes pass like hours, my eyes open wide, staring up at the ceiling, every paint crack memorized. Think I'll reset my alarm to go off extra early, wake him up and get him out, try to sleep until 8:30. Being up all night's alright if it's filled with erotic delight, but I can't sleep, 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 I can't sleep.
And from that same album is one I especially like called Cowboys Are Frequently Secretly Fond of Each Other.
This is a good story. The writer, Ned Sublette, is from Texas. He's from West Texas, I think Lubbock. And the song, as I heard it, was actually the second version he recorded. I've never heard the original. I've asked him, but he doesn't want to let it out. It never got released. When he was living in New York in the mid-80s, as part of the new music scene there, he had recorded a very odd version of this song with odd instrumentation. And it had come out on a collection put together by John Giorno, the gay poet from New York, who had a label which used to get arts funding grants called Giorno Poetry Systems. And the Giorno Poetry Systems albums, a lot of it is spoken word. He had William Burroughs, Ann Waldman, Laurie Anderson. He put out these compilations, which would be a combination of spoken word, poetry, and music. And on one of these albums was Cowboys Are Frequently Secretly Fond of Each Other. And I got it from the Champaign, Illinois Public Library. And I think I got it in like 86. And I loved the song. I just thought it was so good. I had to return the album, so I taped it on a cassette, which I still have. And when we started the band, we did a bunch of covers, usually as the B-sides to singles. A lot of those songs were either songs that I thought were by gay people or suggested that there was a gay meaning to the song. That one was obviously clear. There was nothing hidden. And I thought that was a song that needed to be rescued, plucked off the heap of obscure songs. So I'm really glad to have dragged that one out there. And people hear it and they think, oh, well, that's a song I wrote. But I didn't. The guy who wrote it's a hetero. And he told me that if you stand out as being the least bit creative in West Texas, you're called fag. You're called homo. So he said, you know, because I asked him if he was gay. He said no, but, you know, that's what he was called as a creative kid in an uncreative environment. And so that's what he wrote the song about. I think it's a great song. And Willie Nelson's version, because he does it kind of slower, more waltz style, he omits the final chorus and the second verse. So our version is more complete. But I like Willie's version too. And I think it's great that Willie did it.
There's many a strange impulse out on the plains of West Texas. There's many a young boy who feels things he don't comprehend. Well, small town don't like it when somebody falls between sexes. No, small town don't like it when a cowboy has feelings for men. Well, I believe in my soul that inside every man there's a feminine. And inside every lady there's a deep manly voice loud and clear. Well, a cowboy may brag about things that he does with his women. But the ones who brag loudest are the ones that are most likely queer. Cowboys are frequently secretly fond of each other. What did you think those saddles and boots was about? There's many a cowboy who don't understand the way that he feels towards his brother. Inside every cowboy there's a lady who'd love to slip out. Well, 10 men for each woman was the rule way back when on the prairie. Yet somehow those cowboys must have kept themselves warm late at night. Well, cowboys are famous for getting riled up about fairies. But I'll tell you the reason a big strong man gets so uptight. Cowboys are frequently, secretly fond of each other. That's why they wear leather and Levi's or belts buckled tight. There's many a cowboy who don't understand the way that he feels towards his brother. There's many a cowboy who's more like a lady. Well, there's always somebody who says what the others just whisper. And mostly that someone's the first one to get shot down dead. When you talk to a cowboy, don't treat him like he was a sister. Don't mess with a lady that's sleeping in each cowboy's head. Cowboys are frequently, secretly fond of each other. Even though they take speed and drive pickups and shoot their big guns. There's many a cowboy who don't understand the way that he feels towards his brother. There's many a cowboy who keeps quiet about things he's done.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along. while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. And as I said, this is another one of my shows where I have much too much great material for just 1 hour. So you can find much more on my site, including more of this interview, an interview with G.B. Jones, and several special segments on queercore music. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Saturday night, Sunday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. We're up to the 1996 album Wish I'd Taken Pictures, and it included an interesting song called Vanilla.
Chris had written James Bondage, and I thought, good, good for you. That was the first song he wrote for the band. I thought as a alternate to James Bondage, I would write Vanilla. Because Chris really wasn't into the things he sings about in James Bondage so much. Vanilla, yeah, that's fairly me.
I've never heard anybody write about that.
Good, then we did something unique.
I'll do you sexual favors, but I'm not into those sexual flavors. Sometimes I wish I was braver. I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla. I know about ropes and whips, handcuffs and nipple clips. That's something I'm gonna skip. I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla. If I really get into you, maybe I'll sing a different tune. But I'm timid, I'm telling you, I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla. People should do in bed whatever pops into their heads, but talk to me before planning ahead. It's gotta be mutual, be mutual. So you're into discipline, it turns you on the more I sting. You're liberal but fantasize right wing. I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla. You'd like some skinhead boy to be your bootlicking bedroom toy. That's fine if it brings you joy. I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla. I'm happy to fantasize, do whatever might arise. And even though I like surprises, I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla. You know I'll never be as kinky as you want me to be. If that's not enough variety, tie someone else to your bedpost, to your bedpost. I'll do you sexual favors, but I'm not into those sexual flavors. Sometimes I wish I was braver. I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla.
Also from Wish I'd Taken Pictures is the song I Really Wanted You.
That song was written and recorded for The Outnumbered. It was on the second Outnumbered album. And it was about a friend of mine who I used to hang out with, who I didn't know if he was gay or not, but who I was quite attracted to. And then one day he told me he had met this woman, and this woman just sort of sunk her claws into him, like really deeply right away. And I thought, ugh, you know, it's something that I hoped might develop into something for me and him, and then it didn't. So that's kind of a lament.
Jealous reaction, but after all that time we spent.
Your book is subtitled The Inside Story of the First Openly Gay Pop Punk Band. Your film is subtitled Life in a Gay Rock Band. How do you differentiate between those terms?
I think my book publisher wanted to be more specific, and I had written the title of the book, and they came up with the subtitle, and I said, sure, that works. I kind of use the phrases interchangeably anyway. We're indie rock band, we're a pop punk band, we're a punk band, we're a rock band, gay rock band.
So in more general terms, how do you differentiate between punk and rock?
Punk is generally noisier, edgier, shorter songs. There's definitely a punk rock sound that is rock and roll, but at the same time specific, has a specific tone to it. And even though punk has a lot of wide parameters, people define it differently. I didn't want to just call us a punk band because I think it doesn't really describe what we do. It kind of narrows what we do.
What does queercore mean to you?
It was first homocore. When I got to San Francisco in 89, there was a zine called homocore. But in 1990, that was the year, I think in retrospect, the year of the queer, where suddenly the word queer got reclaimed. I think it was by ACT UP people or activists in general who were saying, you know, you want to call me queer? Yeah, I am queer. So I'm going to defuse that term for you. You call me queer, I'm going to accept that. And that was when you start hearing the phrase queercore. The funny thing about homocore, the magazine and the movement, is that they were starting to write about queer rock bands when there really weren't any. There was a cassette tape that JD's put out, Juvenile Delinquents magazine, Bruce LaBruce and G.B. Jones. But a lot of the bands that were on this tape, which I think was 89, I can't exactly remember what year, but it was definitely before Pansy Division, seemed like just a lot of ad hoc groups, like bands that like just got together to record a song or something, but not a band that you could really go see. Bands, for the most part, didn't make records later. So it was kind of like the idea of homocore or queercore or a gay rock band. People imagined it before it really existed. But what is it? It's edgy, noisy, blunt, and very in-your-face rock and roll, punk rock. A lot of it's funny. A lot of it is confrontational. There were a lot of people who just said that they were fed up and weren't going to take it anymore. And they made this music that was, you know, sharp-edged.
So was Pansy Division queercore?
Yes. We were poppier, though, than I think a lot of the other people who were associated with the term were. You know, I was aware that even though the fit wasn't perfect for us, yeah, we're a queercore band.
In 1997, the band released their album called More Lovin' From Our Oven, and it included John's salute to Canada, called Manada.
I had been curious about Canada and had never been up there until Pansy Division first got to tour up there in 94. I always thought that Canada would get overlooked. People in this country, I think, in general, think that America has all the answers to everything, and then we don't look around at what other countries in the world are doing to solve some of the same problems that we have. Having that attitude made me more curious about Canada. So I was really happy when we started to go up there and started to get popular up there. And the experience of being up there and getting laid frequently caused me to write the song as both a tribute to the men of Canada, and the country itself, which I think is a great place that I think gets overlooked.
Every time I go north of the border,
They also recorded that song in French, and how many of you noticed that about halfway through, I switched to that version? Over the years, Pansy Division has become well known for their cover versions, and they did a very fun one of the Josie Cotton song, He Could Be the One.
From Valley Girl soundtrack, you know. Just a song Chris liked, wanted to do, thought it'd be a good one that we could do without having to change the lyrics.
Yesterday I met a guy, the kind you dream about at night. He said, come on, let's take a ride. And I said, okay, yeah, every movie made was really hip.
He's hip.
Uh-huh, he could be the one to come and steal my heart away. Super fine, I can't keep him off my mind. I know he's not a waste of time. He's got it all, yeah. Every movie made was really hip.
He's hip.
Uh-huh. Got my name and number and I'm waiting on his call. Hey, oh. He could be the one.
I like his style.
He could be the one.
Love's on trial.
He could be the one to make it all worthwhile. He could be the one. 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 In this modern day and age, I'm just another passing stage. Everybody's out to score, but his love to me is so much more. He could be the one. He could be the one. He could be the one to make it all.
The album Absurd Pop Song Romance from 1998 had a different sound and was lyrically broader. Talk about that and how the album was received in contrast to the ones before it.
We took a different approach on Absurd Pop Song Romance for several reasons. One was that it was our first album with Patrick on lead guitar, Patrick Goodwin. He had joined our band right after More Lovin' From Our Oven came out, our fifth album. Absurd was our sixth album, and having him aboard gave us the ability to have a broader range of sound. But as far as the lyrical content goes, we had reached a point where we thought that if we continued doing what we'd been doing, that we would be repeating ourselves. You know, I realized that, and sometimes I'd show Chris new songs I'd written, and he's kind of like, you know, that's kind of like this song you already wrote before, or, you know, this lyric is kind of similar to this and that. I felt like we'd reached a point where we wanted to evolve, but also felt like we needed to evolve. And one of the things I had always wanted to do from the beginning of the band was, in every song, somewhere in the lyric, there had to be something that was overtly queer, like whether it uses the word gay or, you know, uses the word he if I'm talking about a love or sex object. And I got to the point where I realized people know about our band now. We've made 5 albums. We don't have to spell it out all the time. People now get the context that we're in without needing to be reminded of it constantly. So on that record, that was when we shifted to making some of our songs either, you know, without any gender being mentioned, or maybe addressing more universal situations. How was it received? It was actually received very well. However, it came out at a time when the scene that had propelled us, the sort of post-Nirvana, post-Green Day, alternative slash punk scene, was kind of fading. None of the bands on our label, for example, were selling as well as they had. So, bad timing. We had really good timing in so many ways, but when we made what we thought was a career move, like here's a record that will like start a second career for us, reach a whole bunch of other people who may not have been into the punk stuff so much or the humor stuff so much. Here's a more serious record. Here's a record with more musical chops. But it didn't reach the people that we thought and hoped would appreciate it. It's still probably our best record, but we felt we'd kind of done our best shot and had sold less than our others. But I think whatever record we would have put out at that moment would have sold less than the others. I don't chalk it up to that record in particular.
You had 6 albums of new material in the first 6 years and then 2 in the last 10. Talk about that change in frequency.
After Absurd Pop Song Romance, we stopped doing the band full-time. And we had done it full-time since 94, 5 years. So in 99, we did a tour that year, but we had all gotten jobs. And after that, you know, with the experience of Absurd Pop Song Romance not taking off like we hoped, and the fact that we had other jobs we needed to do, we were less inclined to just get together and make music. So when we finally did, it was actually not that fun a process. But we did get Total Entertainment done, and I think it's a real good album. But at the same time, it wasn't as much fun at that point as it had been earlier. So after Total Entertainment came out, we did a tour. And then Chris went to school, which really detracted from our availability. He did a 4-year film degree in 3 years, so he was not available most of the time. But it was a good time for him to do it, because we really weren't sure how much activity we wanted to do anyway. So it had gone from being our whole life, or at least most of our time and energy, to being something that was a hobby we got to indulge every once in a while. And it was fun doing it that way. But after that, people started spreading out. Patrick quit the band in 2004, but with Chris being in school, there wasn't much reason to be too active because we just couldn't do much. So we kind of went a while without a guitar player. I had hoped that we would make another record someday, but by the time I finished my book a couple years ago, it looked like that wasn't going to be the case. So I had a couple of songs that I wanted to record, and it was hard getting everybody together. Chris was in Los Angeles. Luis, Joel, and I were in the Bay Area, but Luis was making plans to move to New York, and Joel eventually moved to Boston. So now there are 4 of us in 4 different cities on 2 coasts. However, I wanted to record a couple songs, and when we went into the studio to do them, we had such a great time that I thought, well, I'll do these songs. I think they're great songs. I guess if Pansy Division's not going to make another album, we're not going to record them. I thought, let's just put them on the website. You know, maybe we'll put out a single or something. But they're just, I thought, really good songs. And when we did them, we had such a good time that we decided, no. The results were so good and we had such a good time doing them, we thought, let's make another album. But since we're all living on different coasts, it took a year and a half for us to get the album done and another 6 months to get it released. So we began it, working on it in April of 07, and it came out at the end of March 09. That's So Gay, the new album.
And that very quickly brought us up to date. We'll hear about several of the songs from the new album and a whole lot of songs from their whole career on part 2. And we'll also go in depth about why John wrote the book. What do you see as the future for Pansy Division?
It'll, I think, go back to being an occasional thing. We are doing a tour in 09, but our tour is shorter than I'd hoped for when we discussed it originally because of people's life obligations. So I think in the future we'll probably, I mean, the way that we worked on this album, doing demos and then working on them from a distance, then getting together and suddenly just, you know, whipping them into shape and recording them. That's the way we did it this time. We'd like do our demos, get together one day to learn the song and record it the next day. I would have never in the past thought that we could have done that and had such good results, but the fact that we did means it's a template for further activity. So I think we'll probably make more records, but not right away.
Looking back, what do you think is the place in gay music history of Pansy Division?
In our film, Chris says that one of the things that we're trying to show by our band's mere existence is that the gay experience is a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And I think that we really helped expand the idea of what the gay experience is by having the band that we have and doing it the way that we have.
I agree, but I want to go a bit further than that, and I couldn't say it much better than Tom Robinson. His assessment is, and I quote, "Few bands outside the mainstream ever write songs so striking that listeners will rush out and buy them on first hearing. But I think Pansy Division is one such band. To this day, their back catalog remains hugely liberating for any gay music fan who's grown up immersed in the het pop, macho rap, and metal posturing of Western youth culture. The songs are also tremendous fun. Their riotous celebration of male-on-male sexuality remains a unique achievement in pop music history." I'm down to the last song. This went way too fast, and I want to thank you all for listening, and John Ginoli for the wonderful interview. You can find out more about the band at www.pansydivision.com, and much more of this show at my site at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I've featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. I'm closing with one of their most popular songs, and it's from their 1998 album, Absurd Pop Song Romance. It's Love, Love, Love.
It was from the idea that pop songs lie to you about love and set unrealistic expectations in our lives as to what love will be like someday when we grow up. I'm just pointing out something that's already there.